Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin. In keeping with last week's podcast theme on ecumenism with Jim Papandrea, today I am pleased to welcome Professor Marian Larson, a professor and the chair of the Department of English at Bethel University in St. Paul, Minnesota. Dr. Larson has served as a visiting scholar and sat on the board of directors for the Collaboration for the Advancement of College Teaching and Learning, and also served 6 years as the Arts and Humanities Editor for Christian Scholars Review. Her scholarship focuses on interfaith dialogue, faculty development, and hospitality as a metaphor for teaching. She is the author, with her Bethel University colleague, Professor Sarah Shady, of From Bubble to Bridge, Educating Christians for a Multi-Faith World, recently released by InterVarsity Press and the focus of our conversation today. As it is difficult to host two guests simultaneously on a phone interview, we chose Professor Larson to be the one chatting with us today, but I must note that Professor Shady did have some input into this interview, as I provided many of the questions in advance, and they both had a chance to sit down and talk them over. I should add that Professor Shady, the co-author with Professor Larson, is a professor of philosophy at Bethel University, specializing in mid-20th century continental philosophy, the construction of healthy communities and political societies, and the role of religion in politics, especially with respect to interfaith dialogue. Dr. Shady's writing have been featured in the books Faith, Film, and Philosophy, The Pietist Version of Christian Higher Education, a chapter she co-authored with Marian Larson, and Walking Together, Christian Thinking and Public Life in South Africa. Together, Larson and Shady's work has also appeared in publications such as Liberal Education, Journal of College and Character, and the Journal of Educational Theory. The two have worked with Interfaith Youth Corps, a Chicago-based nonprofit whose mission is to bring together young people of different religious and moral traditions for cooperative service and dialogue around shared values. Both Marian and Sarah have been recipients of the Bethel University Faculty Excellence Award in Teaching, Professor Larson in 2001, and Professor Shady in 2014. We will link to the websites of From Bubble to Bridge and the biographies of Professor Shady and Professor Larson on our website, so please check out all of that. Marian, thanks for joining us on Research on Religion.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, this is certainly a timely book given all the tumult that we've been witnessing across the U.S. and specifically on college campuses over the past few months. However, it should be noticed that books take a long time to write, and that
Yes, they do.
Actually, how long did it take you to write this book?
Oh, it's kind of hard to say. We've been working on the ideas for probably 6 or 7 years. Actually, working on the book itself for a little over a year.
Okay, so yeah, the actual writing, but yeah, books gestate for a very long time. Actually, give us a little history of how you came to write a book about engaging individuals in multi-faith dialogue.
Yeah, I think that it started about 8 years ago. I was on sabbatical, and I was working on a project connected to thinking about hospitality as a metaphor for what a professor tries to do and be in a classroom. So I've been reading a lot of Christian theology around the history of hospitality and what that meant. And I kept coming up against some ideas that I knew, Sarah's office is right down the hall from mine, and I knew that some of these ideas connected with some of her interests. So we had coffee together one day and realized that we had very similar interests and concerns when it came to the kind of teachers we wanted to be. And we had complementary knowledge that overlapped enough that we could talk intelligently to each other, but that was different enough that writing together seemed like a good idea. And for us, the move from seeking to be hospitable hosts in the classroom to to then, and helping our students deal constructively with difference about ideas that they really care about, the move from that to interfaith dialogue felt like a pretty small move, actually.
I'm interested in this concept of hospitality as a metaphor. I'm a classroom teacher as well. What do you mean specifically by that?
I first started thinking about that idea in reading one of Parker Palmer's books, To Know As We Are Known, probably about 20 years ago, and he says to teach is to create a space in which obedience to truth is practiced. And in that book, he then unpacks all of the different aspects of that definition. And I have been particularly drawn by what it means to think about teaching as creating a hospitable space, that it might mean that it doesn't mean every single idea that comes in the classroom is accepted, but it does mean that every idea is given a fair chance, is tried on for size, that we think about treating each other in the classroom respectfully, but also thinking about the text that we might bring into class, even if they're texts written by people who are long dead, as kind of temporary guests in the classroom, and ask what might it look like to prepare ourselves to honor the ideas that we're encountering, to be open to ways that we might learn from them, and then how might that then change the kind of people we become when we leave the classroom.
And I can see how this is dovetailing with the work that you're doing here with From Bubble to Bridge, with different people of different faiths all coming together. So hospitality is going to be a big factor, and you mentioned that quite a bit in the book. I also mentioned that books often take a long time to get into print, and part of that reason is all the copy editing. But I'm guessing because you're a professor of English, you didn't have any problems with grammar or anything. It sailed right through.
You'd think that's the case, and I'm thinking of how many times my eyes looked at a particular version of the manuscript and how many times Sarah's eyes did and how many times the editor did. And I thought we were ready to send our absolute final version in, and I had pieces of paper all over the dining room table. My husband walked in the room, picked up one piece of paper and says, "Oh, this is a page from your book." Looked at it for about 5 seconds and said, looks like you've misspelled Barack Obama's name." So we realized that it doesn't matter what level of education and how careful you're being to try to catch errors, they're going to crop up no matter what. But yeah, we took care of that before we sent the manuscript in.
Okay, at least you got that one. But that's a lesson I try to tell all my students. I ask how many of my undergraduate students are good writers, and a bunch raised their hand, and I said, nobody's hand should be raised, not even mine. I've been writing for many decades now, and everything always comes back in red pen to me as well. So it's always great to have a lot of different eyes on it, and also to have a co-author, too. Just a really quick reflection. You mentioned a little bit in the past that Sarah's down in the office from you, and so you had some chatting about this. How was it working with a co-author?
It's been great working with Sarah. I realized, at least in our case, I mean, we literally write everything together. I mean, I don't mean we sit in the same room and generate one sentence at a time together, but the parts of writing that Sarah enjoys or at least doesn't hate too much are different than the parts that I'm good at. So, for example, if I've been reading something, we'll meet for coffee and I'll say, "Well, let me talk to you about some of my ideas." She'll take notes while I'm talking, and then she'll say, "Oh, this fits really nicely with something I've been reading," and I'll take notes while she talks. And then one of us will say, "Hey, I'm noticing there's these three common themes." And Sarah usually is the first one to get a particular article or a particular chapter going. She says, "I can kind of picture how the first couple pages of this might go." And that's the part I hate the most. So she'll get that started, and then I'll pick up where she left off. And we kind of trade back and forth. I'm virtually always the final, I guess, st-
style editors, we together have sort of come up with a writing voice that's a little bit different from the voice that I write in when I'm writing alone, or that Sarah writes in. Anyway, so there's lots of back and forth. There's not a single chapter in this book that only one of us wrote.
Yeah, that's cool. A very fortunate relationship to have.
Very much, yes.
Yeah, it's one of those the joys of academia that we often underappreciate. So great to hear that. Your book that both you and Sarah wrote is called From Bubble to Bridge, and both you and Sarah start off with a rather honest assessment of life in academia, which is that's a life lived within a bubble. Discuss what you mean by bubble and perhaps what kind of bubbles students on Christian campuses such as Bethel might experience.
Yeah, I'm a graduate of Wheaton College in outside Chicago, and when I was at Wheaton, I don't remember us using the term bubble, but we still talked a lot about recognizing that there's something about a college campus, especially a small private liberal arts school, that is what many people at Wheaton describe that campus as, pervasively Christian. The faculty all have to sign a faith statement in order to teach there, and it's really clear to prospective students that if they aren't Christians, they're probably not going to get as much out of the educational experience as they might have hoped for. Sarah went to Taylor. They actually use the term Taylor bubble there, sort of in distinguishing between what on-campus life is like and what it might feel like outside of campus. And when I started teaching at Bethel, I noticed that students and faculty and student life people all talk about the Bethel bubble. So we realized that it wasn't just one of our campuses. It was at minimum all three of them. And I think it means a variety of things, but, you know, one is, as I already mentioned, at schools like ours, the faculty are Christian, essentially all of the students are Christian. On our campus, religious diversity means a Lutheran and a Baptist have a conversation about infant versus believer baptism, or I might, in a class of 20 students, I might have one or two students who self-identify as Catholic. That's about the level of religious diversity that we have on our campus. And then added to that is the fact that just geographically speaking, our campus is suburban, very isolated. It takes significant effort to get off campus. There's a Bethel-owned shuttle that can take students on a 10-minute ride to the local mall, and from there, students could catch a city bus or a light rail if they wanted to go downtown. So if students don't own a car, even just getting away from campus is a challenge. So it's partly meant to connote a sense of isolation, I guess in both the good and bad senses of that word, a realization that bubbles are fragile and bubbles are temporary. And while it can be good to be a part of a bubble, spending too much time in a bubble can foster a mentality that can over time become rigid and self-protective. And rather than just being seen as a temporary space, can become what Eboo Patel has called a bunker of isolation.
You talk a great deal about this in the book, and you also reflect upon this on the college campus, noting early on that a Christian university is not only in existence to educate students by providing them with lots of knowledge, but also by building character of an individual. Mm-hmm. And that involves challenging one's faith to better understand that. In a bubble, that could be very difficult. So explain what you mean by building one's character at a Christian university and the challenge of doing that in a bubble.
Yeah, Sarah and I both had very positive undergrad experiences in our bubble environments. And I think a lot of students on our campus similarly have a positive experience. So I think what I would say from a positive perspective is there's something to be said for a classroom where, for the most part, people feel that they're all on the same page, that we have similar goals. I know that students come to Bethel because of course they recognize they need an undergrad degree from a reputable school if they hope to go to grad school, if they hope to get most jobs that they might want to seek later. So I know that there's that credentialing that happens in a college. But they also sincerely want to develop as thinking, caring, well-equipped Christian people. And they don't all mean the same thing by that, and there's a lot of changing in thought and in perspective on the world that happens to someone during the college years. But feeling like we're all kind of preparing for the same thing, we can have really productive conversations in my office or in class and really kind of ask hard questions about what does this mean, how does this relate to your faith, what are the range of ways that a Christian might think about this idea. So I think there's a lot that's positive to be said about that. I think certainly the negative can be how can you be equipped to serve God and neighbor if you don't really know who your neighbor is, if you don't have a clear sense of the range of ways that people understand what it means to serve God. On our campus, we talk a lot about the importance of education being both challenging and supportive. And I think that the danger of a lot of bubble environments is that they're very, very supportive, but probably not challenging enough.
And I can see how that's a danger, too, because eventually students graduate, at least we hope they do, and move on, and they're going to go into the world outside of the bubble. Us academics can kind of keep staying in it, which is very comfortable.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. On the other hand, a lot of students have to leave this bubble, and that means they're going to encounter people who are not like them, that have different faiths out there, and Minneapolis is increasingly pluralistic environment. One of the tasks of your book is to make the case that interfaith dialogue is more important than ever, given that we are living in this increasingly pluralistic world. So make a case for that.
Yeah, I'll make the case for it first from and one of the ways we talk about it in the book, we have one chapter where we talk about it largely sort of the civic mandate. And then secondly, we talk about it from a Christian perspective, the theological mandate. So I'll talk about the civic mandate. First of all, it's simply a fact that we live in an increasingly religiously diverse world. You don't have to read the paper more than once a week even in order to pick up on that idea. Because of immigration, because of globalization, more and more people are coming into contact with each other. There's greater variety in who might be working at the right down the hall from you in an office, or who might live right down the street in your neighborhood, who might be going to school with your kids. My husband and I live in a first ring suburb just south of Minneapolis. And when our son's been out of high school for about 8 years now, when he was in high school, he played on the soccer team with several Somali teammates who would fast during Ramadan, and that happened to coincide with the state soccer playoffs one of the years that my son was in high school. So even that kind of contact. So civically, how can we learn to share the schools, the public spaces, the government, the civic spaces that we have in common? How can we learn to share those better if we don't know who our neighbors are and aren't equipped to interact with them in a knowledgeable and respectful way? Miroslav Volf, a theologian at Yale, talks about the fact that we don't have to agree theologically in order to join together socially. And he makes the point that people from many religious traditions, for all of the differences in theology, at least have some overlapping social concerns, a desire to serve other people, and by doing that, to show our honor of God, a desire to improve the world for each other and for our children, a desire to look out for the poor and needy. And the problems in the world are so big that if we don't join together, we're not going to get anywhere. And I think also just pragmatically speaking, the majority of people in the world use their understanding of religion as a way to make sense of things. And if I'm to hope to be a peacemaker, I have to get to know those people and have contact with them. Eboo Patel makes the point that diversity is a fact, but pluralism is an accomplishment. Pluralism means the ability to a willingness to cultivate relationships with people that I don't know, that I think might be different from me, a willingness to seek to learn things about what others believe, and be open to appreciating aspects of what they know and believe. So I think that's a big part of the civic argument. I think the other thing that I would add into the civic argument is that fear begets fear and trust begets trust. If we stay in our separate bubbles and aware of how fragile our bubbles are, if we let them become if we take sort of a hunker down bunker mentality and stay separate, we're going to continue to pass on misconception and fear, which then snowballs and becomes a deeper problem. So I think that's probably enough. I think about the social mandate, the theological mandate is actually, in my view, kind of a short one, and that is we know we're commanded to love God and to love our neighbor as ourselves. And the more I think about what it means to show love of neighbor, the more I realize that I can't love my neighbor unless I know her. And by knowing her, it means partly learning broad things about groups of people, so maybe gaining some kind of basic levels of religious literacy of the sort that say, Stephen Prothero talks about. But it also means getting to know individual neighbors, taking the initiative to learn about them so that I can care about them and so that I can be an agent of fighting misperceptions, fighting misconceptions, refusing to bear false witness through my own ignorance.
Now, religious pluralism has gotten a lot of attention in the news recently, and there's an argument out there that people say that in order to avoid all this tension and this conflict, it's best just to keep your religion private. Get it out of the public sphere. If we live in a more secularized society, all these problems will go away. You don't necessarily take that approach. So tell us why you might disagree with that and why we should still bring our faith to the public sphere.
Yeah, I can think of a few ways that I might answer that one. I would say we live in a country with a First Amendment that says we have freedom of religion. I know that that different people interpret that differently in terms of what that means. But I think that in general, what it has meant historically and what it does mean is that we try as much as possible in this country to give people permission to express their understanding of matters of ultimate concern, whether that's religious or non-religious, to allow them space for that to shape how they orient themselves in the world, how they express themselves, how they vote, to the extent that that's possible. And so part of making space for that includes making space for religion to shape a person's interactions in the world. I think the idea that there can be such a thing as a naked public square is a really false idea. everyone, regardless of a person's religious beliefs, everyone is shaped by their understanding of whether it's a moral code or a philosophical basis. Everybody brings assumptions to the table that shape the way they think about important matters and shape the way they vote, shape the way they interact as citizens. And so removing religion from the public square ends up privileging other ways of thinking about matters of ultimate concern and ends up not doing anyone any favors. I think also pragmatically speaking, because what we believe shapes who we are, whether that's from a religious perspective or not, and because many people in the world who do self-identify as religious already feel under attack, we increase the likelihood that people are going to sort of retreat to their own bunkers and be combative and argumentative if people don't feel that they can express who they are religiously.
One of the great things that you do in your book is not only talk about this theoretically, you also have some pragmatic solutions we'll get to in a little bit, but each chapter is paired with an individual story that helps to put a vivid face on the message that you're writing about. And you do this early on in the book, this chapter on how we get out of our bubble and how we preserve our identity yet engage the community. And in this first chapter here, you talk about the director of community engagement at Bethel University, and I hope I can pronounce this name right, but Tandon Brekke? Tandon Brekke, which is a very Minnesota name. That's, you know, it sounds like Norwegian, Nordic somewhere.
I think he's Scandinavian, yeah.
Okay. What is his story, and how does that all relate to what you're writing?
So Tandon used to be in our campus ministry's office. Sarah and I started working with him, I think, about 8 years ago, early in President Obama's term. The White House established an interfaith service challenge and invited college and university campuses to participate in this challenge. And Sarah and I, working with Tandon and a couple of other people on campus, wrote a proposal to have Bethel be one of the campuses that was involved in this challenge. And at the time, Tandon was the person in charge of the outreach programs that come out of campus ministries, and also the person to plan various alternative spring break trips that work with Habitat for Humanity and other things. His main area of interest and concern at the time was issues related to racial reconciliation. And now he works, he no longer works in the campus ministry's office, but he works as the person who coordinates service learning efforts in a local neighborhood of St. Paul that is very diverse in socioeconomically, racially, ethnically, and religiously. And so he's been working with that neighborhood for a long time. We've been working with him in the White House Challenge. And he had been wearing his racial and cultural diversity and the need to reconcile there. He'd been wearing that hat all along. And then working with us and making some contacts with a mosque that's in that particular neighborhood, kind of had a light bulb moment of realizing that there's significant religious diversity in that neighborhood also, and kind of thinking about the intersectionality of all of those aspects of people's identities coming together.
Very cool story, and this makes the book all the more readable and accessible to a lot of individuals. A lot of this sounds like tolerance, and you make a very good case for tolerance, but it's also a relatively nuanced case for tolerance. And recognizing that tolerance is only the first step, in your second chapter, you start to talk about active interfaith engagement. Why is that so important? How does that relate to tolerance, and how is it best accomplished?
Yeah, so speaking of tolerance, the terms that we use in the book are tolerance, affirmation, and inclusion. Inclusion is the Jewish philosopher Martin Buber's word, and we spend quite a bit of time working with that in one of our chapters. But I think the way I would talk about it is, I would describe tolerance as simply recognizing the other person's right to hold a particular view. And at times, that's certainly a good start, and at times, that's maybe as far as we can go. Affirmation is I could maybe argue that that's almost at the end of the spectrum by saying that is keeping my mouth shut and focusing on seeing through the other person's perspective. And at times, that's a really good idea as well, but that can be taking things so far that I feel that I can't be who I am. And inclusion is saying, I'm going to tolerate, but I'm going to seek to go beyond toleration as I develop a relationship with this person. At times, I will affirm and simply listen, but I'm not going to stop there. The goal is to seek to develop genuine relationships of give and take, meaningful relationships despite differences. In terms of how... I'm trying to decide how much detail I might go in here.
Go ahead. Let me ask this, because your book has a lot of visual representations of abstract concepts that makes things clear. You're an English professor, so the use of metaphor is always very good here. In that chapter, you bring in the term hospitality, which we talked about a few moments ago, but also this concept of dwelling. Dwelling is not only, it's a place, but it's a verb as well, too. You're dwelling in something. So explain how all this works together with the concept of interfaith dialogue.
Yeah, so in the chapter where we talk about hospitality, Amy Oden has written a really helpful book, not specifically about interfaith dialogue, but just looking at evidence of hospitality in literature produced by Christian biblical scholars and theologians sort of over the history of the church. She argues that there are sort of different kind of different phases in the act of hospitality, and we've combined some of them together sort of into two. One is the phase of welcome and restoration, and then the second is the phase of dwelling and sending. And one way that we try to talk about that, drawing some ideas from her, is welcome and restoration, as it might relate to interfaith dialogue, is to say, if I'm hosting an interfaith dialogue on my campus, am I seeking to create a space that would be welcoming for people from other religious traditions? Am I demonstrating openness? Am I willing to listen? Am I willing even to receive and learn from the other? Am I paying attention to details like the food that's being offered, or the way that I'm dressing, or whether or not shaking hands with somebody is appropriate with this particular culture? So if I'm the host, I'm thinking about those things. If I'm the guest, visiting a mosque or visiting a synagogue, participating in an interfaith dialogue off campus, I'm asking those kinds of questions. And I might say, if I think back to tolerance and affirmation, there's a lot that sounds like tolerance and affirmation that goes with the welcome and restoration part. But then dwelling, and then that ends with sending, I think dwelling is really the time of spending more time together, of realizing sometimes interfaith efforts might consist of a one-shot deal. I take students to a mosque to observe prayer one time. We do an interfaith service project with students from a range of houses of worship in the Twin Cities, and then have a meal together afterwards. That might be a one-time thing, and that's where I think welcome and restoration is probably the best part of thinking about hospitality. Dwelling and sending is, that's really the ideal. That's when, over time, relationships can develop. And having spent more time together, I can feel more comfortable to be myself, to ask hard questions, to acknowledge this is maybe where we do agree, but here's where we don't agree. Or in the classroom, I can think early in the semester, I'm being as accepting as I can of perspectives that students might take, but then we push each other a little bit harder as things go. So that's the dwelling part. And sending means this is the end of this time of hospitality. So it's a temporary end to a relationship, or maybe even a permanent end, and a recognition that once people who have been guests in my classroom or on my campus have left, I can't control their perceptions of me or of Christianity. I need to be willing to let go. We also talk about this in the book, but another visual image here is Miroslav Volf has the image of the physical embrace, and he says there's four movements to the embrace. There's opening arms, there's waiting, there's closing arms, and then there's opening them again. Opening arms is like the act of welcome and restoration. I'm showing to the other, I'm willing and willing to have a relationship with you. I desire to talk with you and get to know you better. That means I might have to wait. And then while we're together in dwelling, there might be a time of closing arms in the positive way as an embrace. We're getting to know each other, sharing more than maybe we could previously. And then I'm opening arms again, signaling I'm ready to let you go and to have you let me go, but I'm opening my arms, showing that I'm ready to have another interaction again.
One of the stories that you use to illustrate this, all these concepts at the end of that chapter, is Jenna B. Tell us a little bit about Jenna B. And also, I guess I'm kind of curious about this. Why not the full last name? Why only B?
Yeah, so it's Jana.
Jana, I'm sorry. Yeah,
no, that's okay. So Jana was raised in a conservative Christian home. When she first came to Bethel, she was interested in missions and thought that becoming a nurse would be her best path into missions. And it was through that major that she ended up working as a home healthcare aide one summer. And she tells that story in the book about realizing that being a good home healthcare aide might potentially require her to get to know something of the religious background and beliefs of the people that she was caring for. And that then raised many questions for her. She since then has helped to start an interface, a group called the Better Together Group on our campus. We don't give her full name because her home background is conservative enough that she's not comfortable being open with all members of her family about aspects of her current thinking. So she asked that we not use her last name.
And that leads into an interesting question, too, about interfaith dialogue. And, I mean, this puts Jana in somewhat of this intersection, is that one of the big concerns by Christian leaders, also by Jewish leaders and parents, is that multi-faith engagement could lead students to start becoming theologically relativistic. They say, oh, all these different religions I'm experiencing away from home, they just must be all the same, so why even bother, you know, keeping my own faith? That's something that you wrestle with, right? It's an interesting question that, well, you know, that's why, you know, many parents send their kids to the bubble to protect them in that regard. But is there that great concern about preserving your identity? How do you wrestle with that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a parent myself, and I totally understand concerns that a parent might have. I would argue that, in my view, that's one good argument in favor of not only having a bubble, but if you're going to have schools like Bethel and Wheaton and Taylor, that's a good argument for having interfaith engagement occur in the context of a school like that. Because my son and daughter, who have both graduated from college now, they both interact with a much wider range of people than they knew when they were in college. So it's going to happen at some point, and I would argue better sooner than later in the context of a supportive Christian environment. When Sarah and I have taken students to off-campus interfaith dialogues as part of a course, we have students write about it, and then typically one or two class periods after we've been to a dialogue, we'll process things together in class and talk about what questions got raised, how can we equip students to think about how they might want to answer those questions. So that would be one of my answers. And I think the other answer that I would give is virtually every student development kind of model of cognitive and moral development that I've ever read. I'm thinking of things like William Perry's scheme, Larry Brascamp, Chickering. So many pictures of, this is even outside the context of interfaith engagement, in talking about what kind of cognitive and moral growth do we hope to see happen among traditional age college students. And it's always a move toward being able to acknowledge that there's a wider variety of ways of seeing than they might have acknowledged when they were 18. There's more ambiguity in the world, and then to help equip them to reflect and engage thoughtfully with the greater complexity in the world. Kind of helping students to develop a stance, a more humanizing stance toward their toward religious others than the stance they might once have held. So one of the things we talk about in the book is that for some people who are liberal theologically, the belief is anyone who would try to proselytize is being thoughtless and uncaring and is being dehumanizing. And I would argue that there are that statement in itself is a dehumanizing statement, that it's closed-minded to argue that any person who believes their faith to be the correct one must be uncaring. And I would argue instead that what's important is cultivating a respectful and caring and open-minded stance toward the other. That's what we're trying to cultivate in students. And we talk in the book about the kind of virtues that we're trying to develop in students. And so I'll just mention that now, since I've kind of hit on that a little bit. But we talk about three of them, and this comes largely from the work of the philosopher Martha Nussbaum and the theologian Catherine Corneille, and that is developing receptive humility, reflective commitment, and imaginative empathy. And I think it's really reflective commitment that I've been talking about. I do want my students to graduate from Bethel still feeling strong in their Christian commitments, but I want them to be able to express their commitments in a thoughtful way that shows that they are willing to be challenged, that they are informed by humility, that they can maybe even admire something in another religious tradition without feeling that that threatens their commitment to their own. I read an article once talking about the concept of holy envy, where a Christian student who had listened to a practitioner of another faith talk about some of their prayer life, and this person said, "Wow, I wish I had a prayer life like that." So I think that's what reflective commitment is. Receptive humility is acknowledging that I have something to learn from other people. At minimum, if I'm in an interaction, say, with a Muslim, they certainly know more about Islam than I do. So at minimum, I can learn more about their religion. I can learn more about the way they think about God, about their perspective on my faith. I think I owe it to people of other faith traditions to hear from them about how they see Christianity, and to be willing to try to correct misperceptions, to apologize for times when Christians have been unfair in their treatment of other faith traditions. And then imaginative empathy means trying to see from another's perspective. So I think that those virtues can absolutely go along with a person who's well-grounded and committed to his or her faith. But that person might talk about his or her faith in a slightly different way than they did when they were 18 and had not interacted with people of other faith traditions.
I have to interject here a little bit because I'm coming from a different context, being a Christian at a large public university in Seattle, which is kind of the heart of darkness when it comes to religion. A lot of religious nuns out here and people who don't go to church, and actually people who are pretty aggressive against those who are religious. One thing I've noticed on my campus, that there's been a great deal of effort to promote inclusivity, and there's somewhat of an odd paradox that has resulted from this, is that the more we emphasize inclusivity, the more students have been breaking down into their own increasingly tight-knit homogenous groups. And that, I mean, that speaks to something. I want to preserve my own identity, but I want to engage others. Given that you're at Bethel University, I'm at University of Washington, I don't know if you've seen this, but how would you somewhat reconcile that or provide some kind of reflection upon that phenomena?
Yeah. Well, in a way, I think you're asking three or four different questions all at the same time, so I think it's complicated.
Yeah.
So the tendency on any campus for students to want to hang out with people that they feel safe with, the tight-knit, homogenous group, I don't think we should try to fight that. That's the safe space. That's the people who understand my jokes. That's the people who get me. Even on my campus, where there's a lot that students have in common, there are still many, many subgroups that develop because it's never the case that everybody thinks exactly the same way. So I would say that having those, allowing those subgroups to exist, I think that's a good thing, or at least that can be a good thing, but allowing that to be utterly unchallenged can be problematic. The political theorist Robert Putnam, in his book, in Bowling Alone and then in American Grace, he talks about societies having bonding capital and bridging social capital. And he argues that societies need both. Bonding capital is the sort of thing that gets developed in groups of people who feel that they have a lot in common. So in those homogenous social groups, the more they spend time together, the more they are developing bonding capital. That's like the kind of thing that would happen in a Bible study or at a church or among students in a Muslim student association. But bridging capital is also an important social glue that helps those different groups of people learn to interact with each other better. And diverse societies, if they're to be healthy, need both bonding and bridging capital. And so maybe I sound like I'm speaking out of both sides of my mouth, but I want to say I think the evidence is that homogenous groups are understandable and even good because they provide bubble environments on campuses like yours, and campuses like mine might be kind of a larger bubble environment. Everybody feels misunderstood and attacked in one way or another for some reason. So on my campus, I don't think Christians feel attacked. A particular kind of Christian might feel under attack. On your campus, Christians, I think, legitimately would argue that they feel under attack. So finding ways to help people talk across lines of difference is a really important one. One thing we talk about a little bit in the book that I think is partly related to your question is that there's a small amount of literature out there on the notion of Christian privilege, kind of taking concepts around white privilege and asking, in our country, is there such a thing as Christian privilege? And it's interesting because there's, I think, a lot of evidence that the answer is yes, and resoundingly yes, and resoundingly no. Resoundingly yes, in that so many things about the work calendar, the work week, the academic calendar, the number of available churches, Christian religious holidays, sort of shaping to some degree what national civic holidays look like. The fact that a person still has to kind of in some way identify as Christian, or at least not sound too threatening to Christians in order to get elected, that all sounds like evidence of Christian privilege to me. But then I'm sure there's a lot of evidence on your campus and other secular campuses that expressions of Christianity, at least expressions of some kinds of Christianity, are far too quickly and too easily criticized and are not treated fairly. So I think for many Christians, experiencing social status ambiguity is a very real thing, which adds complexity to this whole picture, I guess. I would say.
Definitely multifaceted. One of the things that you do in the second half of your book is you provide practical advice, and a lot of this practical advice is not only through your work at Bethel and working with different students, but also through something known as Interfaith Youth Corps that both you and Sarah have engaged with. You have a story about somebody named Amber Hacker in the book as well. Perhaps you could, you know, in the time we have remaining, give us a sense of what are the practicalities of putting your ideas into action via Interfaith Youth Corps.
Yeah, so Interfaith Youth Corps is a Chicago-based nonprofit that was founded by Eboo Patel. He wrote the foreword to our book. He publishes a lot. He gets interviewed a lot. He's a Muslim with a PhD in sociology who in his first book called Acts of Faith, he says, "I was a social activist who wanted to do good in the world, and I felt trained to think about religious and cultural difference. And then I had this light bulb moment of realizing that, wow, in this country we need to learn to engage religious and philosophical difference also." And so he has been kind of on the front edge of an interfaith service movement. And Amber was, as a college student, volunteered with Interfaith Youth Corps, and then ever since graduating from college, she's been on the staff of Interfaith Youth Corps, and she's now the vice president for operations and communication. So Interfaith Youth Corps is an organization that hires people of a wide range of religious and philosophical beliefs, and then they provide resources and consulting work. They've got a speakers bureau. They run various conferences, all meant to help equip mostly college and university students to come to see themselves as interfaith leaders, as people who are kind of ready to engage difference around matters of ultimate concern, and then find ways to come together across difference with particularly a civic concern. So this is a group that is willing to interact about theological issues, but primarily says, let's talk about how we can, Eboo Patel talks about being able to cross the faith line and engage together in doing acts of good. And so Amber is on their staff. Two of the people that write, April Lenker, who's one of the people that contributed to the book, also has done some work with Interfaith Youth Corps. They've done some work on our campus. They've Eboo Patel spoke recently at the annual president's gathering of the presidents of the council, schools from the Council for Christian Colleges and Universities. And then Eboo Patel, one of the people on his staff, Noah Silverman, and Jenny Howe Peace, who is on the faculty at Andover Newton Theological Seminary, they're co-editing a book right now on the emerging academic field of interfaith studies. And Sarah and I are contributing a chapter to that as well. So kind of one direction that some of this work is going is taking something that has started as sort of a social movement and asking what different academic disciplines might contribute to this, what kind of intellectual equipping might help prepare people from a range of academic disciplines in order to go out and cross the faith line together.
Yeah, and an enormous amount of useful, practical advice is in this book. And again, one of the things that I like most about is these individual stories you mentioned. April Lenker, she's a Christian in a Muslim club, which is, you know, absolutely fascinating to hear that in this day and age. Mm-hmm. You just got to go, yay, you know, this can happen. Yeah, it's really kind of neat. I want to finish off here with a few minutes that we have left. Thinking about your own process in writing this book and maybe sharing some of the thoughts that Sarah may have had as well, because writing a book is not just a means of transferring information from one person to another. We oftentimes think it that way, but those of us who are authors recognize that it's a personal intellectual journey as well, and that we learn things that we never expected to learn in the process. Did you or did you and Sarah have any of these kind of eureka moments where you're going through the process over discussing this for several years and then all of a sudden say, wow, you know, we never really realized that. We really learned something in this process.
Yeah. Well, I mentioned that one of the things that drew me to this topic in the first place was my desire to think more seriously about what it might mean to be hospitable as a teacher in my classroom. And so working on this book has reminded me that and has challenged me. I sometimes need to turn the book over and not look at the cover if I feel like I've been not particularly charitable towards someone with whom I disagree. So I've been reminded that, wow, these words are in print now, and I've talked about the way that we need to treat people from other faith traditions, but if I'm not willing to show the same hospitality toward fellow Christians, I probably shouldn't be writing this book in the first place. So it wasn't so much a light bulb moment, it was more of a letting my own words convict me moment. And I think the other thing that Sarah and I have found ourselves talking about more and more is realizing that, so when we first started this project, we thought, wow, why is it that there aren't very many evangelical Christians who are willing to be involved in various interfaith dialogues and interfaith efforts that that Sarah and I have attended? Not many evangelicals attend things that are run by Interfaith Youth Corps, for example. And then we realized a lot of interfaith efforts tend to attract people from a range of religious perspectives who have one thing in common, which is they tend to be more progressive politically, socially, and theologically. And so people who don't line up with that description, whether they're Christian or Muslim or Jewish or Hindu or atheist, people who are more conservative often feel less comfortable in contexts like Interfaith Youth Corps. And so we've spent a lot of time actually talking with Eboo Patel and some others at Interfaith Youth Corps about that very question, that realizing our identities are far more complicated than just I am a Christian.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of the next direction we're going in terms of some work that we're doing.
Well, that work sounds absolutely fascinating, and we'll have to keep our finger on the pulse of what you're doing in that research. And it's kind of cool to note that Bethel, being even a small liberal arts college out there in Minnesota, this is the third person we've had from Bethel on this podcast. So, very cool. I know. I was looking that up the other day, too. I was like, wow, that is really kind of cool. So it's been spectacular having you on the show. My guest today has been Marian Larson. Marian, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Yeah, thank you, Tony.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.